Okay. Would you mind stating your name and spelling your last name?
Jeff Metoxen, and my last name is Metoxen.
Great. And I'm Sam G from the University of Wisconsin-Madison. So, last time we ended by talking about your time in the Oneida Police Department. So, when did you leave the department and what did you do next?
I spent between 6 and 7 years with the Oneida Police Department, and the reason I had moved on was because the Oneida Tribe had established a gaming commission. So from the late 80s, mid-80s, until about the mid-90s, I was with the OPD, and gaming for tribes became nationwide with the Indian Gaming Regulatory Act. They went from having bingo, which is called Class 2 gaming, into the casino-style gaming of machines and slot machines and table games, which is called Class 3 gaming. And the federal government, through the IGRA, Indian Gaming Regulatory Act, I think it was passed in 1988, set up the guidelines and requirements for those tribal nations that decided to go into Class 3 gaming, requiring a separate entity to be its regulatory authority. For us, it was called the United Gaming Commission, and we had those members elected. During a General Tribal Council meeting, that's when our people, their voting age, get together to make the decisions or hear reports. I had been asked to run for the position, thinking it'd be interesting to try something different. That's the direction I went in, and I was elected to the position of Gaming Commission for about 7 years, from 2003. They range from being in just for 1 year through terms to 3 years. So until the year 2000, I was functioning as a member of the United Tribal Gaming Commission.
Until the year 2000?
Until the year 2000, when I did not get elected back in. Very hurt feelings. But I realized I wasn't that much into the... I'm not sure this... the right thing to say or the way to say it, but the political arena, political world, because I was an elected position, I really didn't campaign. And because of elections, you really needed that. It was families and who you know and numbers, but I didn't put an ad in our tribal paper, which a lot of people do, and it's normal. I didn't create signs or signage saying elect me for Gaming Commission. So as much as I can be upset, and that's my own feelings, I also didn't do, I feel, enough to get back on the Gaming Commission. And that really was my wish, but I didn't take that role, more active role, to get back on the commission. And that's where the time frame of, from middle of 2000, looking for a job. I'd worked for the tribe since basically 1983, 84, and worked with them till the year 2000. And we have a really nice process, I feel, through the Oneida Tribe, that even though I wasn't elected in, I never really stopped my terms of service. Mm-hmm. So when I did get a job here at the Junhinkwa program, I was hired in January of 2001. And it was for the retail supervisor position that I started in.
Okay. So what was the transition like from serving on the Gaming Commission to coming to Junhinkwa?
I guess that's some of the things that I've always kicked around, and I think I've been doing this, when I look back all my life, it's been really from that serving point. So not only being on the police department and serving the community and the people, but the Gaming Commission was, as a regulatory authority, it was to serve the people, to ensure that our games are following all rules and regulations. And so still serving. And when this change took place, it was a different role, hugely, because it went towards the retail area of a store for a program, but the program itself always talked about white corn, always talked about food, always talked about processing. So it was still that balance of what is it that we can do that the community wants or needs. And maybe that's been a lot of the challenge I've faced is we weren't looking at items to put on our shelves to sell. It's like, okay, people are asking me about what can help us with our diabetes. You know, it's natural. What can help us with our blood pressure? What can be healthy choices for us? And so that little change, I think, is what I've always looked at as far as the approach goes for the program and myself. Even though it was retail, and we've evolved beyond that right now.
So can you, just for the sake of background, I guess, sort of describe Junhequa, how it seemed to you when you came, its sort of its mission, and what its some of its main activities are?
What was put me in a position was I was looking for a job. So when I didn't get elected back in and I needed employment, I was applying for everything. So up until getting the job here, I had never heard of Junhequa. Even though it's been around since, I would say, 1996, it really probably kicked into gear. So for those 4 years prior to, I knew about Whitecorn, and I knew that our people always grew it, not necessarily that the tribe through this program of Junhequa did. Part of the Junhequa program at that time, it had three entities. There was an agriculture part, which we are at now. There was a cannery part, and the cannery has been around for the United Tribes since it started about 1977, 1978. So it became part of Junhequa, and there was a retail part. Our agricultural site right now, we're on 80-acre site. This is a former dairy farm. So the house we're in is actually offices. Nobody lives here. Right now, second floor of my office, and then across from me is the two guys I work with. They have the other bedroom office conversion and downstairs and so on. So it was a living room that hosted the store, and that's where we were at. What I looked at was to recognize I'm hired now as a natural retail health store supervisor. How do I ensure that I understand what the responsibilities are of that position beyond just being a store supervisor, but learning about the products, learning about what we're trying to offer? And that still hasn't stopped, even to this day. So it's recognizing, I mentioned earlier how we did gardening when I was a child, and I really didn't care for much big parts of it. But knowing that in this position, even though a store supervisor, the whole program and all the people, we were connected in staffing. So maybe I didn't know canning, food preservation, and food processing, but I had to understand a little. And it helped, I think, by helping my mom, not much, I use those words as pretty loosely, with canning. When you were kids, she would can green beans, apples, applesauce, making different products. So my small knowledge in canning there when we were kids growing up and helping both my mom and my grandma. Agriculture, having a garden here, growing the white corn, remembering what we did as kids and we were eating white corn and why. And then the store itself, we have these products, and from this standpoint, since we weren't, I think it was beneficial not to be profit driven, even though you're retail label, it seemed to be much more, I don't know what the best words, but consumer driven. So if we could offer not just one product that may help you in a different area, but we may offer three different types of products that you could select from and then share information that if we didn't have something, you could go here. So it was still serving the community, and I guess I felt like it was, and I still feel that today, which I really enjoy, a challenge. You never stop learning. You never stop trying to understand, and you really never stop, hopefully, examining yourself and what you do. And not just repeat that, but learn from it and improve. So it was a little different world, and I enjoyed that part.
Yeah. So you mentioned that Junhequa was and is more community-driven, consumer-driven. So I'm curious, who are the customers of Junhequa, and how do you engage with the community?
From looking at the history of the program, and it's something I'm still learning about, is like, I would ask, well, what started Junhequa other than getting a job? You know, I didn't know you guys did all this and worrying, looking at and trying to understand and trying to always improve ourselves. I didn't want to be the person working here saying, do this better, do this more. It was more like, okay, it was more or less trying to take that point of what are we doing and why, and how's that going? So when they would work on the white corn and I was understanding it more, that it was a traditional food that we're supplying to our community, it was understanding that I would remember my own connections of white corn and having 1, 2, 3 families we knew that grew it that allowed us to have it 2, 3 times a year. This program was working to produce enough white corn that allowed our community to have it anytime, as long as we had grown enough. I would think as it was growing, the Junhequa program, since the mid-90s, its consumers, its clients or customers were primarily tribal members, our tribal family are connected to today, where it's a pretty good mixture of what we provide with all the products and services that our program offers. I mentioned earlier how we went from being a 3-component entity of agriculture, canning, and retail, is that the evolution now today has us at agriculture and cannery. Retail, although no longer part of us, we still work with them, and they're part of the enterprise side of the United Tribes. So they're at one of the either convenience stores or at their natural health food store, which is located near Green Bay. And we still have our products on the shelves at the Oneida Market and at the Oneida One Stop 54, one of the convenience stores the tribe has. And so we have been around enough that through word of mouth, I think, grew the customer base, client base. The reason the Junhequa program itself was established is, as I read of the history and talk with the people that are around here yet and help develop it, is the foundation of the program did begin with the cannery in the mid-70s, late 70s, as it went through growing stages, at times shut down and then opened up again. Starting a garden for the people that worked there so they could process some food, is that our community was asking us how can they learn how to process, which is what the intent of the cannery was. What about helping us find other products that could be healthy for us in so many different ways, that I think all those questions kind of help form Junhequa's foundation, is that recognizing, wow, this program could be the entity responsible to not only keeping white corn, a traditional food, around for us, but then growing it beyond what we're doing and what started then. Having healthy products for our people to select from, such as the grass-fed and grass-finished beef that we have, working with poultry and doing not only egg layers, but doing the broilers, our meat birds, and then having the gardens. So I think not only the people that worked in the cannery helped to establish Junhequa, but other areas, as I understand it, helped get this program foundation established. White corn primarily was it. However, there was a part of everything we talked about, sustainability, traditional practices, these areas. And I look at, we haven't really changed that foundation at all. And our customer and client base just keeps kind of building from that. Even though we've evolved as a program itself, good and bad, I kind of look at the benefits we've been able to provide, and I think they far outweigh the challenges that we face.
Yeah. Okay, so you've mentioned that one of the primary components of Junhequa's work is growing the white corn. So I'm curious what the importance of the white corn is for this community, and what experiences you've had with it.
I don't know if I'm saying this right, but I believe the Oneida word for white corn is onust. So the white corn itself, if we talk about onust, it's been our food, our sustainers. And the food itself that I talk about is always for the people. It's human consumption. It is not meant as silage, not meant for feed for cattle or poultry or any animals. It's part of our creation story. So when we talk about the white corn and we share the ceremonial practices and our traditions and we go to our creation stories, white corn itself is mentioned in there about providing as one of our sustainers. It's part of the Three Sisters process. For us, the corn, beans, and squash is a garden that provides a symbiotic relationship between the corn, beans, and squash. And it's that specific white corn that is part of it. And growing up, and what I've been sharing is how the little I've known, white corn was a treat. I loved it. Maybe because we only had it two times a year, three times. But I love the soup, I love the bread. And our program has been able to take that and allow it, provide it to our community. And it's been to me, I like that part of, it's not just a tribal food. We have so many people, I think, that have an interest in it. And we recognize the importance of it, not only within our culture and our traditions, but I look at how we apply the care for it that I think we've been able to provide such quality products and keep it around. We face many challenges. Can we do more? Yes. Can we plant more and use machine? Yes. But I think it had hurt the quality that we have. And yet we still face the natural elements that at times we have what people may call a drought, and yet our white corn still grew. We had where it'd be too much rain, yet our white corn still grew. We didn't have the best soil, but the white corn still had grown. And to me, I look at that as we've developed this relationship with the corn of being respectful, being mindful of its needs, and taking care of it. And that's an important aspect that I feel as to why it's still around. And we work hard towards that. We do not always make the best choices. We've not always done the right thing, but we've never really lost as to... We've seen the different varieties of value that can be applied to our white corn than just how much money is it worth.
Great. Yeah. Okay, so I think that we skipped over something big here, which is when we started this conversation, you were talking about your work in the retail store. That is not, however, what you do now. So how did you switch from working in the retail store to running Junhequa?
I'll share what I can, and that it was, I thought it was kind of funny. When I was hired in January, learning, the position of manager became available, and I was asked to be the interim manager. So it was a challenge to being brought on and being the employee with the least amount of experience, yet had been requested to take on the role of interim manager, because the position was open, by February or March. So being a retail supervisor for a month, two at the most, at this Junhequa program, and within that time frame, being interim manager of the entire program, of Ag, Canada, and Retail. Tried to take a very slow and deliberate approach, and I had feelings both ways. I'd love to have this job. Of course, obviously, it pays more. There's more responsibility. I was very comfortable with that, and I wanted it. But by being so new, I knew that there's could be a chance I'm just filling in until they post a position and the person is actually hired. Our process within the tribe is, if that happens, an interim position is put in place, just that you hope to have something more permanent and official within 6 months to a year. Through various areas and reasons, which I don't always understand, I was interim manager for about 3 to 4 years. When they finally posted it, I applied. By then, I was very comfortable, and I wanted the position, and I fought for it. I did think that I deserved it, but I knew it wasn't my selection process. I knew very well that if they select someone else, I would go back to the retail supervisor, which wasn't in existence yet. I was very happy and to get that position, to finally be called Jeninko manager, not interim Jeninko manager, which was the tag was applied all the time. And I used that. I always let people know I'm functioning in this role, but I am the interim at this time. And the changes that I was looking at was before I revised anything, and I still do this today, I don't want to change this because I want to, and I don't want to change this because I said so. I was using that time to understand our program even more. What is agriculture's responsibility? What are we trying to do with white corn, the gardens, the greenhouse, everything? What is cannery's responsibilities? Beyond processing, making products, getting to some of those specifics, and then what is the store's intent? I realize it's profit, but we didn't want someone, and I never changed my position, to walk the door and sell you as much as I can. It was really more like educate as much as I can. So that's what I used to work on and still work on, is that approach and saying, all right, we want to grow white corn for the community. So if we've planted 2-3 acres in the beginning, today we're up to 10, about. We're finding out what our capacities actually are. We have cattle here, and when I started, as an example, working with the people that were here, we had 45 head of cattle, and it was a mixture. We didn't set on a breed until years later. So looking at all the responsibilities that came with that, it was recognizing, even though I didn't know specifics, we had too many cattle on our property to be talking about intensive rotational grazing. We're having chickens that we butcher, and if our intent of the program, as an example, was to have fresh birds that we processed out the door, well then we really shouldn't be freezing any. So it was trying to take that and not necessarily, and it was interpreted this way at times, I feel, in a negative way. Well, if you aren't doing 325 birds every single year and you go down to 200 birds, you're wrong. You're accepting a loss and you're failing. And if you have 45 head of cattle and you can't find a way to make sure that they're all good, intentional rotational grazing cattle, then you're wrong, you're failing. Hearing those comments, I didn't agree with them whatsoever. I didn't have any problem arguing against it, because I took the approach that if you're doing too much, you need to step back and take care of what you have. And if that means reducing, then you reduce. Don't just keep doing something because someone said do this. And we're still working on that today. So although we're looking at reducing our cattle head over this time, reducing the amount of birds that we do with poultry, and in the opposite direction, we've taken white corn and expanded the acreage that we planted. And we're still trying to find how much we need to produce. So I've tried to look at that from agriculture, cannery, and retail, and continue to serve the community.
Mm-hmm. Who are the people who were criticizing what you were doing?
It was internal as well, not just external, but internal. And I think a lot of it, and I understand it. I may not have agreed or approved of it, but it's a change. It's what I've always done. I've done this year after year, been here. And it was that same question I knew at times were in people's head, but maybe it wasn't voiced. Who are you to change? Who are you? You just started here. All you have is background in retail. You weren't even with us a month or two, and all of a sudden now you're this position. If they didn't say it, I would say it. And I would try and share that viewpoint of always saying, I'm not looking to reduce cattle head because I told you so. I'm looking to reduce the cattle head we have because we aren't able to feed them with the resources we have available. We're still having to buy in the hay they need. We're having too much damage to the pastures that we have on site. If we talk about intentional rotational grazing, in a sense, it doesn't matter how many head you have. If you have 10 head of cattle, 30 head of cattle, 100, or 1,000, if you talk about intensive rotational, you're moving them probably every couple days, at least once a week. That's intensive. If you just talk rotational grazing, you can give them a few acres, let them eat, then move them next week or two. Then move. There are some challenges to that, and you have to have enough pasture lands to do that. And we're looking at providing good quality beef through pasture-raised cattle in this process. And so as I was learning more, it was applying that. So it's not just because I said, it's like 45 head is too much. There's a simple math formula people may share, and they'll say, well, you need 1 acre of land for every cattle you have. That's a nice generic number. I've heard that before. But then you factor in all those variables of, well, one's a calf, they don't need an acre. One's a bull, they may need more of an acre. So you use it simply as a guideline. I always felt, I think it's been a long time, that we should raise not more than 25 head of cattle. That process, if done properly and things work our way, we may have only 4 to 5 cattle to offer a year. We wouldn't be like a lot of other producers that provide that one cattle every month, one cattle every other week. We don't have those numbers. And so those people would bring, I'd hear some things negatively from many areas, like I said, not just internally, but externally. And I would generally share why I'm looking at this change, that why aren't you doing more chickens that can order more? And, you know, another thing to face is, as example, if we had chickens available and we're offering it at this price per pound, well, somebody would come in and buy 30 chickens. Mm-hmm. And because of our process of being organic certified, and it'd be free range labeled, and say we sold it for $3 a pound, and they bought 30 chickens for that much, they had the resources to do that, they may turn around and sell it for $5 a pound. So that's not what we're intending here to do. We're really trying to reach more families and individuals. So we start limiting the numbers that you could buy. You could only order maybe 10 at the most. We recognize that they're not supposed to resale, but you never know what people do. And I was fine with those changes. And instead of having frozen birds that we didn't know where to store, you know, we aren't a retail area, and that scale, I'm talking about a living room that was a retail store, we didn't have rows and rows of freezers or refrigerators to put these products in. Our intent with poultry was to process them, butcher, package, and get them out the door within 3 days. Now, if we can't do that with 100 birds processed in June, it doesn't make sense to me as to why continue, no matter how long you've been doing it. So these changes that we made went back towards, all right, let's do 60 birds, let's do 50, and see how that goes. And that's kind of what we're into now with the changes.
Cool. So your background is not in doing this sort of thing in agriculture. So I'm curious, in the process of being the interim manager and then getting the official manager position, both what you've learned about this world of agriculture and growing and farming, and how you learned that.
One of the things I share with people in my position, one of the evolution changes is our tribe went through all the positions necessary, trying to stay updated. And so titles change, descriptions change, responsibilities kind of change. We kept trying to update. A handful of years ago, my position changed from Junhenqua manager to Junhenqua director, and that's where I'm at now. Mm-hmm. Responsibility really didn't change. Still over agriculture and still over cannery, and at the time, retail was around. But the job never really changed from, I'm usually here when we're talking in a desk, on a chair, meetings, reports. I am rarely at any time on a tractor. I am rarely at any time in the cannery processing. I would try and help out where and when I could. So to me, it was a never-ending learning experience. When I was learning about gardening, it was because of what they're doing here. So they have a very small production garden. The concentration over the years was really, what does the cannery need? So they would grow towards that end. We've done trials with being part of a CSA, Community Support Agriculture. We've done trials being part of the farmers market in our area and selling our products there. White corn is a never-ending challenge, and I actually do love that, and I think we've grown so much of being part of it. So I may not be seeding with the tractor, but I've gained a great deal with the hands-on harvesting process that we follow. And although I don't process it in a soup, I've gained a great deal with talking with our cannery people and those workers. So I've got a little hands-on learning in all areas, and that's, I think, what I'm really grateful for, is the people I've worked with who are here currently, as well as those who are no longer with us, for a variety of reasons, both good and bad, that have taken that time. Usually I mentioned how I didn't want something done because I said so, regardless of my position, unless I felt it was required. And I've done that, but pretty rarely. It was usually to try and understand, okay, what is agriculture worker responsible for, and what are they doing, how's it going? What is the horticulture farmer supposed to be taking care of? And the same would apply for cannery and retail. That's where I think I've gained a great deal of experience. So trying to understand what they're accomplishing and changing with our times, and I think it's really helped that whatever the foundation of the Jinhinka program is, not just with white corn, but talking about sustainability, talking about food, helped us to focus, to not go offline so much. And we still do, which we did and we still do, but helped me recognize the importance of, all right, do what I can. I'm not here to do your job. That's what the position was hired for. You're responsible for these areas. What I'm looking for is you to do them. Let me know what your concerns are, and we'll see how we can help. If it becomes a major issue, we need to change, we'll change. We've done that, but it's trying to get a comfort level. At times, I think we're no different than other entities. We aren't. We have the same problems. Personnel issues, attitudes, that when they come up, you have to address. But I keep reminding myself, and I don't do this, relax. We'll get through it. We'll be okay. We need to change. I get that. I may not agree with what you're saying, but we're going to keep going. You may not agree with what I'm saying, but keep going. Trying to find a way. I don't want to sit here and just bitch about an issue. And it's so easy. Anyone can do that. And I don't want them to. It's always reminding myself and in sharing that thought process. If you have a concern, how would you like to address it? Doesn't mean you're going to get it, but don't sit back and keep tearing apart someone. Don't sit back, keep tearing apart an entity. What would it be like to do? That's where I've worked hard to take that position, to understand my responsibilities, and also help the people here understand theirs. Mm-hmm. Great, complain, share a thought, share a concern. That's good. I don't necessarily agree with you. I don't think it's right. What would you like to do? So that it's too easy to blame someone. It's too easy to look at that. That's not my responsibility. That's not my job. So wait a minute now. We're all working here together. We're trying. I'm not asking to take over your job. I'm not asking you to take over theirs. But if there's some hands that we can help out here and there to keep grounding us, to keep getting back to that, I think it's helped me learn a great deal. I'm sharing a lot of knowledge in this discussion that I've gained from these people. And I've looked at our entity as growing with its evolution from everybody, good and bad. Everyone here is part of it. This has not been done by me or any one person at all. And I always feel it's important to share that. Mm-hmm. So no one, I started this, I founded this, or I did that. And I say, yeah, right. All right, you had 6 employees with you that got this going. Not targeting anyone, but to keep that thought process out, it's like, everyone here helps. You won't have anything to process if nothing was planted. Mm-hmm. You won't have anything to plant if they weren't processing. So other than venting, relax. Ground yourself. I get it. We have issues. We have to address these. But all of these positions, here and now, and the ones who have moved on, kept us going. as we've been able to keep working towards it.
Yeah, that's great. What would you say that the role of tradition is here at Junhequa? Perhaps specifically agricultural tradition, but any sort of tradition.
One of the things we talk about with our program is we'll say a description. Junhequa is trying to share the traditional agricultural practices of the United Tribe with the community. When I mention that, when I'm talking about community-wise, it's everybody. It's not just tribal, it's tribal and non-tribal, regardless. And part of that foundation comes from traditions and cultural values is we've looked at our environment as how do you work with it, not control it, not beat it to what you want done. How do you adapt? How do you adjust? How do you help one another? And so those, I feel, are big parts of what we've been able to share. When I talked about rotational grazing, it's because you don't ever want your cattle eating your pastures down to carpet level. You're allowing your grounds to heal. The reason we do rotational planting is because we don't want to deplete the soil and its nutrients. We're trying to find a way to give back so that when we plant again in the coming years, we get a good crop. So we've been able to share this thought and this process, I feel, with our community and also continuously learn. Some of the traditions that I would apply here, when I was growing up, we did bergamot. It's a tea, it's a mint tea. And I don't know if I covered this earlier, but just quickly, when we were sick, all I remember is called Indian tea. I know what it smells like, I know what it looks like, I know where it grows. And up until that point, when we were kids, my mom and my grandma, they always had Indian tea. We had a cold, it was great for congestion. So, chest or sinus congestion. Very pungent taste, it's strong. Unless that's how it was made back then, which you can still do today. But I liked it, and for us to enjoy, and I tell people, hey, you know, you need to do what's good for you. And any honey you want, sugar, anything, just season the taste, just like many other things. So I liked the taste of the Indian tea, I liked the way it smelled, and that's all I remember. Working here, I found out that the term for it is bergamot, part of the mint tea family. And another term is called number six. It's been explained to me the number six is because it's the sixth herb that the Creator shared with our people and saying, everything that you need is provided for you. And so talking at that time, everything in our world, from the woods, from the grasses, the trees, the herbs, the water, the sky, to sustain ourselves, it's here. Bergamot was the sixth herb provided for us for these reasons. And so a term applied to is number six tea. Growing up, all I said was Indian tea. Working here, we know where bergamot grows now. In fact, what's really nice, I love about our tribal department, our environmental department, is they recognize some of the traditional herbs that are important to our tribe. So they've tried to plant it, trying to encourage this planting. So they've helped out in having a selection areas for our community. Anyone can pick there. And so in following those same practices, for example, bergamot, we've taken a decision of saying, if you find a field or area that has these teas, don't ever pick more than a third. Because if you do, you can deplete that resource, and which we've done. And we've suffered for it because it's taken years to come back there. So we share this knowledge. We do take it from the modern day terms of collecting bergamot, drying it down. We sell it to the store in bulk, and then they in turn make a tea out of it and provide it to the community by selling it. Mm-hmm. It's again one of those factors of saying, well, we've got to make sure that we cover the cost of this program, and that's what we've addressed right now or always, is not to exist just because of someone saying so or I'm saying so. Is looking at to have this program continue running to cover these positions and have these opportunities, we have to have some revenue generation. So it's the balance again, I think I mentioned earlier, I was saying, how can we offset our tribal contribution, which is close to the 100% of our funding comes from in our budgeting process, how can we help that by having some revenue generation of selling the corn products, the bergamot, and some other areas that allow us to keep these traditions alive, allow us to share these practices? If that answers your question, a little
Absolutely.
Bit of examples.
Yeah. Great. So in our last 20 minutes here, I'd like to sort of, we've been talking a lot about what Junhequa does and what you do here, and I'd like to sort of shift back a little bit to more personal. So, but drawing on your experiences here, of course. So I'm curious, since you have this beautiful, large expanse of land, what open land, any land like this, what sort of significance that has for you? If it's commercial, spiritual?
I guess I look at it not only what can we do now, but what we can help with our kids and future kids and everything else. I would prefer to see 100 one-acre farms than a 10,000-acre farm that's owned by one corporation or one person, because I feel that that direction of 1,000 acres, how much can I get? How much can I plant? And how much chemicals can I do to make sure it grows? That's the concern I have with you. Hear people talk about conventional farming practices. So our program and myself, when I look across and I see these farmlands, I recognize I'm probably looking at 98% are conventional farms, that they sprayed it with a chemical to grow their silage. It's not human food, it's to feed the cattle or to make corn syrup or something else. And it's like imagining what can we do if that was an acre of corn for the people, regardless of what corn it is, not just white corn, it could be sweet corn or anything else. That's what I see as having an impact for our people, especially with our kids, to share that in a good way as to why it's so important. Not how much land I can own, not how much I can do, not how many bushels per acre. It's important. I'm not dismissing that. I'm just saying that when you see some of these lands, we have 80 acres here. Once you're here, it's easy to see, at least I'm able to put in perspective, is we basically have a tree line surrounding us on all areas. But you can perceive how many pastures we have and what it's broken down to. How many field crops we have, or acreage, and what we're doing with it. And as the more I've been learning and seeing how inventive we are, our people, all people are, when you hear about urban gardening, and it's like they talk about, well, I don't have any land, I live in the city. It's like, well, you can still do community garden site or container gardening down to the rural areas. And that, for myself, I would concentrate on the different tribal nations. It doesn't matter if you're in a so-called desert, they're still able to provide food. Or in the mountainous regions, they can still provide food. And in the wooded area, the Oneida tribe, as woodland Indians, we're both hunters and gatherers. And I look at that as I feel we were always agriculturalists. And that's something that I enjoy learning about, trying to provide, and keep moving forward. That I guess my perception is that, okay, how do we do this? I feel I still have a long way to go, but I like tying in, for myself, the stories of bergamot, Indian tea.
Absolutely.
And now, white corn. I mentioned earlier how I remember a lady, Sarah Skinador, her family, picking up white cornbread from her, a wheel of cornbread. And again, just during Thanksgiving, Christmas, hopefully Easter. And although my uncle, Elfin Paulus, he grew white corn. And as a kid, I just remember running through the cornfields. I probably ate more raspberries at his place than anything else. He had a berry patch that as a kid I've never seen better. That I was probably anywhere from what I can remember, I would say first or second grade. And I remember seeing black dirt. It's still in my head of his raspberry patch and how well he took care of it. That all the vines were taller than me and my brother. And in fact, probably tall as him, knowing that that's possible. and that he had so many berries, he had to pick your own style, and we were given a job of picking and filling up these little containers, that he didn't care how much we ate. Knowing that you can do that, that he did this, that must have been back in the late 60s, early 70s, all that's possible. And it's like, why? I keep asking myself, how come we can't do that? How come I can't do that? And I know it's possible. Everything that he did.
Mm-hmm. What would you say personally has been your biggest challenge?
It's hard to say. I guess there's two things that come to mind immediately. One is not to take things personally. That's pretty hard. Well, you asked before about who's criticizing. Hell, I'd like to give you names and titles, where they are, what they did, and I detail every failure they've ever had to show who are you to talk about. So it's like recognizing can't do that. You've got to be able to accept criticism, mm-hmm. and learn from it. And the other is almost along the same lines, dealing with personnel issues. When you deal with people, you recognize they're human. So reminding yourself, it doesn't matter if you're right or wrong, I just don't like you, so boom. And everyone has that. So you have to get past that. And I think depending on your position in your role, everyone has a little different role in that. If you're the director, you work with everybody. Other positions, they may only see this one or that one. So I have to be able to work through any personality issues and try and resolve it. May not solve it, but work on it. And not to take things personally. And if you do, recognizing that you're human, recognizing that they're human, and it's okay. That I think is a challenge that allows you to, you can get by with a tractor breaks down, fix it. You can get by with the crop didn't grow, there's not much you can do about it, so try again and learn from it. But in working with each other, working with people, having that ability to work together, even when you have these issues, I think has been and continues to be a challenge. Mm-hmm. But I love it. I honestly, all the things here, with as crazy as I get and frustrated as I get at times, I guess I see the potential of our program, what we can do here, and the things we've done.
Yeah.
That it makes an enjoyment, far exceeds those challenges and those issues.
Since you've been working with people in the community so much in this job, how would you say that your views on or your relationship with the community here has changed substantially?
No, I'm not sure how to answer, but I think in looking at my past jobs, it's always been that way. Again, as a police officer, it was difficult because you're there to serve people. But in serving, you have to arrest people. So having to take people that are your family and friends or that you don't know, and they feel this way about you, the children do, the elders do, you have to live with that. And it helps you, I think, look at problems in a different way.
Mm-hmm.
Being on the Gaming Commission, that role is, again, serving the community, but what it ended up doing is an entity, as a member of it, you gave a gaming license. You could say it's a signature driver's license. As long as everything is clean, good, cool, here's your gaming license, you can work at our casino. In fact, they benefit you, you have one, and you may want to go to other tribes and, you know, background stuff. Well, it's a little different than a license in the sense that you had the ability to make a judgment call. So maybe they didn't ever break any criminal laws, but there's been a lot of issues that as a gaming commission you could deny a license that would keep that person from getting a casino job or release them from the casino job because this was found out. And that put you in a difficult position, which I've had to do with family and friends. And as much as someone says try not to deal with nepotism, We would generally, we do it good in that because of our relations. But there are still family and friends that I would make the decision not to give them a gaming license. And then you have to put your name to that letter that goes to you and says, your license is hereby revoked, you no longer are able to be employed at the gaming, then they lose their job. That helped you see things in a different way. So taking those positions and coming here, I still look at it as serving people. Mm-hmm. And trying to find, how can I help you, but you still get the request of, here, do this, get it done. We don't do that. We can't do that. If we do that for you, then we can do it for everybody, kind of thing. So it's still trying to find, I think, what everyone does. You want to have a nice relationship with your community. You want to feel comfortable, and you hope that your community feels good enough to you to come to when they have a question. I don't think that's changed for me at all, whether I was with the department or the commission or this position. And then accepting at times, you're going to have to say no. Those past positions and my experiences has, I think, helped me deal with it.
I'm thinking back, as you're talking about this, to our first session when you mentioned that you would talk to your father and he would tell you that you shouldn't just take from the tribe, but you should give back. And it seems like you've, throughout all of these jobs you've done, you've had really a lot of, done a lot of service. So I'm curious, what motivates you to do this? Why do you do these things? Why do you work with the community and dedicate yourself to giving and educating?
I don't know. Part of it, bottom line, I get is my job. When the example department opened up, I didn't think I'd get it. I didn't think I'd accept it, but I got hired. Wow. It's okay. Here we go. Get good at it. Do your job. Work you can. And I screwed up on every job I ever had, one way or another. It's like, okay, get over it, keep going, learn. I think that did come, I'm sure it came from my father, my mom, what I recall, my grandparents and growing up. And I have everything that I think every human being has. I have greed, I have bad, I have good. It's like, you can't let that control you. I have my own vices and my habits. And I say, okay, you're not a kid anymore. You can't blame your mom and dad. You can't blame this situation, that situation. You're in a bad situation, change it. You've done something wrong, do something good. Don't let those things control you or dictate to you. So I used the positions and opportunities I had with the police department to try. Didn't always make the right decision, but try. And I still feel that way. The Gaming Commission, and currently with Junhenkwa, I still get upset, still have had the bad things. I just try not to let them control the decisions I've made. And a part of it is, yeah, do I want recognition? Not gonna lie, of course I do. But I ground myself. I don't run out there and take every interview that's possible. I don't run out there and get my picture in the paper that's possible. I don't do that. I try and make sure. I wouldn't be here if it weren't for the people I've worked with over this time. Good and bad. I've learned something. Even if I didn't like the person, even if I disagree with their activities or actions, I still learned something. And I've tried to share that approach with others. Some listen, some don't. It don't matter in my sense to me, but it's like... I think if you can have an opportunity to do something good in your community, just try, even if it's small, even if it's just in your area. I think I've always taken that position of saying, quit trying to fix the world. Quit trying to tell everyone what to do. Quit trying to fix everybody. Just roll with it. Those changes, those small little changes in your life or in those people you're with, reflect and do spread. Take your time, do what you can. Sometimes I go too fast, and it's my dad who said, slow down. That's why you're making mistakes, that's why you didn't do it right, so remind myself to step back. And that came a great deal from my father.
That's great. Okay, well, I have one more question, and then I'll ask if you have anything else you want to add. But my last question is, as we've talked about your work at Junhenkwa, it's emphasis on education, serving the community. I want to know what community means to you. It's kind of a vague question.
The community to me is where we are now. There are some regional boundaries, but not too much. For myself, they're very vague. Community to me is both tribal and non-tribal. That are going to have both friends and enemies, I guess, for lack of a better term, inside it. That's okay. But we survive together. We live together. We have responsibilities together. I'm not going to try and change the person, if I remind myself, to keep going. I'm not going to allow the issues we have with each other to dictate my actions all the time. They will, or my thoughts, they will. I recognize that as a human. But it's like, you know what? I am not so stressed out right, trying to get this way because of your ego, your energy, your issue. It's like, in my head, I say, you created this. You allowed this to happen. So we've got to survive. And if survival simply means staying away from one another, at times working together, that's fine. Community isn't just Oneida tribal members. My family consists of both tribal and non-tribal, other tribes. So my interpretation is basically, it's hard to put a geographical reference. Like I guess I wouldn't say, maybe is community just the Oneida tribal reservation, which is in both Ottawa County and Brown County, as someone looks at. That's pretty crazy. Part of it's in the city of Green Bay and the village of Ashwaubenon and town of Pulaski and town of Oneida and township of Hobart, which we have a lot of issues with. But other than those politics in there, the community is what can we do to make our community better. I'm hoping those decisions don't negatively impact us, but I know they will at times. But again, I'm not going to let that control my decisions and the work I do. It's interesting that you bring that up, because I've heard the opposite from others. Which is, I don't really have a problem with. I just think it's funny that if different approaches, when someone says community is justice, it's like, wow, do you, my immediate thought is, do you know your family isn't part of what you just said because of who they are when you use that description? In our program, and for myself, community is everybody. So that's why we'll mention everything that we do is open to the public. If I feel they're acting inappropriately, I'll share that with them, internally or externally. It's their decision. Other than anything needing immediate action, I'll serve them if I can, but it doesn't mean I'll enjoy it. And depending on what the responsibility is, I can refuse to serve them. And I don't have any problem doing that. And it's not just because I don't like you. It's going to be more to it. And they'll know that, whether they agree or believe it. That's, again, back to their problem, not mine.
All right, well, is there anything else you would like to add? Anything we haven't talked about or anything that you remember from earlier you want to address?
Nothing offhand. Just talking with you, I mentioned earlier how I rarely open up, I feel, on some of the details we've had, but it feels comfortable where we're at and talking. I say it to a lot of people, if you ever have any questions, comments, thoughts, please get a hold of me. I'll answer the best I can, but I'll tell you right out, at times there may be where I'm not going to answer you and I'm not going to provide you the direction, but I'll let you know that. Other than that, I'm hoping if this is an interest to some people, that it may spark a connection or may spark a networking opportunity, which I think is so important for the work we do.
Thank you.